Thanks very much, everybody. It's great to be here with the sound of the wind in the trees and the distant Lewis. And I apologise for interrupting the tea and cakes consumption. I'm delighted to be here and to be invited. And when I got the invitation, it took me a while to go and kind of amass poetry together, because it's something I tend to write infrequently, because I have this conviction in my head that the world can always do with less poetry. So I tend to follow that. But when I had a look through, I thought maybe I could find something that hopefully will make the time pass quickly enough and it'd be nice to listen to. So before I read any of my own stuff, I wanted to have a quick introduction courtesy of Mr. Philip Larkin, because I heard this poem read out at a party I was hosting about 4 years ago, and it changed my life, because I realised that it was going to be my life philosophy. And it's called, well, actually it doesn't have a title, but it's only 8 lines long. None of the books have time to say how being selfless feels. They make it sound a superior way of getting what you want. It isn't at all. Selflessness is like waiting in a hospital in a badly fitting suit on a cold, wet morning. Selfishness is like listening to good jazz with drinks for further orders and a huge fire. So that's Mr. Larkin. So now I'll start with the first one of my own, which, because I have put them in this particular order, is going to be one which I would have written in around 2002, and it's called Conclusions, and it was published in a magazine called Cronog, which is available in Galway and in bookshops there. Conclusions. Your eyes wall a cold demean full of right angles and stars. Your mouth works between meals without losing its appetite. Your logic is a flooding tide safely veiling the swamp below. Your love a mother's breast out of reach in the night. Your truth a whimsical adherence to the small print. Your questions greyhounds biting the wake of flying heels. Your judgment a Houdini minnow slipping out of the blame net. Your reason beating a boy on the head with a sharp-edged rock. Your godlessness a scream after daddy as he runs out. Your passion a plea to angry mummy to warm you into life. Your Spartan diet a bladed mattock to execute the king. Your confession, a secret, gleeful smile at the Queen's bedclothes. Your totem animal, the car that runs every spike to the ground. Your fragility, the Goodyear tires, the handbrake jerked on the sole. Your fragility, the endless press of tire chain as you roll and roll. Your pity, a rotting stranger waiting for his moment in the car park. Okay, now the next one I'm going to read out is, it was actually, I was genius enough to forget that I didn't have a printer, so I had to write the whole. I had to find the file and write the whole thing out by hand. But it won second prize in the Boyle Arts Festival in 2003, and it's called "Never Trust a Programmer." And for me, it's because I work in IT when I am working, and I have for the last decade, and I write code, so I know the kind of people that tend to be coders, and I know what they're like. So my own resident personal programmer cried off this evening. He had consultancy work to do, so he won't be hearing this, but he might have read it already. So it's called Never Trust a Programmer. Never trust a programmer. That's what I tell my friends over sangria, sushi, chocolate. Go for the innumerate, the plain jerks who won't phone or write. Boors and gorillas they may seem, but it'll save you grief in the end. Never believe your secret parts won't yield to fingers that pry motherboards open, or that any fault won't be missed by eyes nearly blind from running through showers of code, or that his merciless binary scrutiny, a geek party trick to win over the girls, won't turn your one to zero eventually. Staying faithful to the binary principle, programmers come in two kinds, true and false. The false kind do code as a 9-to-5 diversion from the mortgage in the hurling, a chewing gum catapult into the next cubicle. The true kind are rare as owls at midday. They resent machines for not being human. They resent humans for not being machines. They resent you for loving them. Their take on life is void main, tight mismatch, cyclic redundancy, stack overflow, core dump, blue screen tantrum. everything is exclusive ore. They lose each other in assembling, disassembling, hovering on a breakpoint, tides waiting to go out and shut down the moon. The moon stays. It's a design flaw. And finally, girls, never trust that this, stripped of all preceding protocol, might not be the sincerest love poem one programmer has ever encrypted for another. Thank you. Okay, the next one. Now, I'm not that well acquainted with Greek legends, but I do know that there was a guy who had some sort of curse that he would never die. He said, "I want immortality," and they said, "Fine." The god said, "You have it," but they forgot to give him the bit where you stay young forever. So he just kept getting older and older and more decrepit, while never dying. And I thought this guy was called Tiresias, and it took me a while to look up and realize, no, that was a completely different guy. This guy's called Tithonus. So I wrote this poem, and I called it Tithonus because of how the person suited that name. So, on his first date, death stood him up. They restarted his heart in the local hospital after someone found him and called the guards. And so out he was sent to sleety school again, wrist and vein resealed, pain damped down, mouth clamped in a rain-slanted grimace, ready to slash what it craved. He was 12. The second time, he was more aware, savvy enough to lure her back but not take her completely, leave his options open. You know what I mean. He played with death's head so much it turned white as vulture-picked bone in the moonlight. And she missed him a second time. Games, meds tightened him up. Soon he only spoke of her to girlfriends, trying to make them feel insecure, succeeding. Years dragged by before he felt he might desire her again. She gathered herself and waited, but he ducked out with a wry smile. Finally, death threw down her sickle, shouting, "I'm tired of this relationship, tired of the way you try to control me all the time. I need real feelings. Sisyphus may handcuff me, at least he cares." And she left in a flamboyant rustle of black cloak, clattering down his worn stairs, never to be seen again by Tithonus, who closed the door behind her, facing eternity with, one imagines, the same wry smile. So, that one was a less recent one. There is a more, I've been working on some more recently, and there was a competition to write a poem to be published on the Dart. So I was working on very, I wrote a couple and then I refined some. The one that I chose is sent away, and it's, you know, it's been judged the other poems, so obviously I'm not going to read that one. But there was a second one that I almost liked better because it was simpler. So it's a very short, simple little poem, and it's called A Meeting. She walked down to me on the platform at Bray, her buttoned coat long and cream, the footbridge's gantries behind her, I in a dream. "It's good to see you again," I said. "I'm glad you came out." She smiled and said a few words, I can't remember what, before one of us turned back to the dark tiled bustle of platform one, the other to wait for the coming train. I could hardly see for the sun and couldn't tell which of us went where. Only hazily understood, but when I woke once more to the wind in the east, I knew she was gone for good. Let's see, which other ones do I have? Okay, this is another one I have, and this poem was also a prize winner in the Clock Writers competition a few years back, and it was based on a friend of mine had a friend who was badly beaten up in an attack that was probably homophobic, and he was deeply depressed after that event, and his boyfriend tried to talk to him, everybody tried to talk to him, but sadly he later committed suicide. And she showed me his webpage, and on the webpage there was a picture of him and his boyfriend, and they were sitting, and you know, they were on a boat somewhere and they were on holiday, and they looked very happy. And it seemed to me that it was a sad thing that they would have been so happy then, and now he was no longer with us. So I wrote this poem called Photograph of a Man Who Later Committed Suicide. His boyfriend did up a website he will never see. The pictures, dutiful, presenting a past tense with questions, frozen for the coroner to review, or perhaps already rubber stamped for ongoing decay. Past, meaning the smile I saw belonged to no face. and that his lover would have rendered him better if he had, like a Muslim, used line and symbol only. His parents were smiling. They are not smiling now. Catacaze was sunny. It probably still is now. There will be other speedboats, others at the helm, somewhere near where that photograph was taken. He has painted, like Branwell Bronte, an absence in the same place where I cultivated you, knowing the essence of my capture would be lost, knowing I could not have been there when they wheeled you in, by miracle reviving you, vigorously massaging the heart that was to meld with mine and break it so many years later. And their grief at his absence, to me, becomes so charged with anger at your existence that though I never knew him, I feel it over again. Such anger from trying to achieve the impossible. Such anger and grief, restarting. I should explain about Branwell Bronte. He painted a picture of himself and his sisters, and then he obscured himself from the painting in a fit of anger. So that's where that analogy comes in. I had, this is another poem that was published in a periodical called Electric Acorn. Just want to make sure old Philip doesn't fall off. Steady. Good man. And it was a kind of on a similar, a slightly similar theme, but this time it was from something I heard on the news. And the headline was, the title is the same as the headline that I saw. This is not the Air France crash. It was one that was many years ago that was similar. And it was called Plane Split Up in Sky Before Crash. It broke into four pieces before plunging mile after mile to the sea, the choppy water hitting it like merciless amalgam. Mr. Chang, the investigator, said the pilot didn't even have time to make a mayday call before seats, life jackets, teddies, airline blankets, passengers fell out, hurled with brutal speed into the extreme cold purity of the stratosphere. Nietzsche once longed for that fountain, the rare place where Zarathustra could advise his dust-caked acolytes and cleanse their faltering minds. But he too fell for Lou Salome, who tied him to a dogcart. The earth keeps pulling. I say it so. I whose heart had to break before I could lose you. And I think that, on a final note, a little bit more jocular, I think. This is a poem that I like. It's probably a little bit squeamish, but it's about a problem that I think has probably happened to all of us at one stage or another. And it's called toilet paper. Sorry, this isn't a life or death kind of poem, meticulously steeped in the wine blood of meaning and hung out to be seasoned for the best and brightest of editors, but still it must be said. The other day, I entered the ladies on the ground floor, chose a grey laminated cubicle, half lit by recessed fluorescent light, unburdened myself, only to discover there was no toilet paper. And so I had to hike up my tights to thigh level, no further for hygiene reasons, sorry gentle reader, but it must be said. Flush the cistern in cubicle one, half limp, half waddle into cubicle two, lock the door, check the loose seat for those hurriers who missed the bowl, pull tights back down again and flick obsessively at the dispenser till I had miles of clean paper at my disposal to do the honours and flush. You may purse your lips and think it's too much information, but these things happen as well to the best among us. And they matter, damn it. They matter. Thank you.